Hello, good morning, welcome. I am Samuel Trapp. This is International Flavor, and you are on Damn Radio. You can send me emails, should you feel the urge, to live at damradio.com, Samuel T at internationalflavor.com, Samuel T at civicoutlaws.com, Samuel T at modernlawecosystem.com, should you have issues you wish to discuss. You can also phone in 573-746-8020. And join me today. So, I've been following the weather. You can't help it. Freaking freezing your, I don't know, left testicle off or your right nipple. Either way, it's freaking cold. So, there you have it. When I'm in Florida, you gotta say Florida. When you're in Florida, I'm not one of those people that turns the, this is how horrible it is. I'm not one of those people that turns the AC on in the house and keeps it at 65. I don't want that. And, I often kept the house so 75. I thought 75 was rather pleasant, right? And as a result, my air conditioning bills were low. So here I am, freezing my left testicle off. And it's only 32 degrees, but that means you got to keep your house. If you can't keep your house at 75, who the hell can afford that? That's nuts. And so, I'm wandering around in, 12 hats and... I don't do well in the cold anymore. I used to be, I've spent my time in the cold. I grew up in Minnesota, for God's sake. And when I was in the Army, I slept in a snowbank in Alaska in January in one of the coldest winters on record. But that was because I had to. I'm supposedly have a choice. So here I am, sipping warm coffee. That was tasty. And here I am live, coming to you live. I mean live. If I'm still alive, I might be frozen solid. Who knows? From the Lake Ozark Real Estate of the Art Studio. And I'm wearing a long sleeve shirt, a sweater, a jacket. Still have my hat on. I did take the gloves off because it's a little hard to maneuver a mouse should you need to move. But I suppose that's kind of wimpy of me because it's really not all that horribly cold. And it's something people who grew up in Minnesota should be used to, or who slept in snowbanks in freaking Fairbanks and Anchorage, by the way. Did it in both places, and that was depressing. At any rate, I wanted to talk about the weather anyway. And how do you like that? You tune into a radio show, and the guy's going to talk about the weather. But let's do that anyway, because I don't know how to put it. I shouldn't say enjoy. That's not a good word. I pay attention to the weather. I pay attention to natural phenomenon, and I especially pay attention to natural disasters. I've got kind of a fixation with it. When I went to Hawaii years ago, I spent the whole time. I did go one day over to Honolulu. But all the rest of the time, I was there like 10 days or something, and I spent the rest of the time on the Big Island. And I had rented a car, and I drove around the island. There are like 3 active volcanoes on the island, and they were active when I was there. And I kind of, that's one of the main reasons I wanted to go to Hawaii was to see volcanoes. People go there to go on pineapple tours and stuff like that. I went to coffee plantations and tea plantations, and I went and saw all three of these volcanoes and took a helicopter over the volcano. And I can't believe I did that because I'm one of those people, you know, that jumps in the ocean and is going to get eaten by a shark. So if you're the guy flying over the volcano and the thing hasn't gone off in 1,000 years, if I'm the guy flying over, it's going to go off, right? Right as the helicopter goes over the top, right? If you're, going to the Grand Canyon, you're the dude who the wind gust blows off, you know, right there. If there are odds are against it, the odds are it's going to happen to me, right? If, your car's going to break down, you know, 20 miles from home, well, you know who that's going to happen to. On a 1,000-mile trip, by the way, you know, the car will be great till you get 20 miles from home, and that's just how it works. Anyway, that could be a little pessimistic, and so I know people who would say that the universe gives those who think that way what they deserve, and if you think the opposite way, it gives those people the things they deserve. If you think that you're going to be in the 2 percenters of the planet and win. Now, I got to say, I'm fairly lucky. I had this discussion with somebody yesterday. I'm a fairly lucky individual. There was some charity event in Jeff City several years ago that I went to, and they were selling raffle tickets, and you could buy raffle tickets, and the lady goes, "You need to buy 10. I said, "No, I don't need 10. I only need one." And she said, "Well, you know, one." She said, "Why? You know, one ticket was $20. I mean, they were trying to raise some serious money, and one ticket was $20, and you could get, 10 for $100 or something like that." And I only had $20 in my pocket anyway, so that wasn't working. And so I said, "No, I only need one. I'm gonna win anyway." There's 1,000 people in the room. It's the ballroom at the place across from the Capitol. You know, one of the big hotels there. And there's at least 1,000 people in that room. And the grand prize was some wagon, pretty good size wagon, and then several crates around it full of all kinds of various types of alcohol, whiskey, bottles of wine, all that stuff. And, you know, you write your name on it. And I said, "Well, you're going to be, you know, I'll stick around till the end because I'm going to win." And sure enough, I won. And the girl was up there and she goes, "How did you do that?" I was like, "I don't know. I've always been able to do that." When I was in the military and lived in Washington, D.C., I've already told you the stories about how I used to go to Las Vegas every other week. You know, I'd go to Vegas, and you'd only stay overnight because the rest of the time wasn't really Vegas. It was Nevada nuclear test site about, you know, 80 miles or whatever it was west of Vegas. And you'd go out there and blow crap up, and then you'd get one night a week in Vegas or on your return trip or whatever. You know, it'd be there. And I had a pretty damn good, my odds charts were unbelievable for Black 17. So my birthday is the 17th of the month. And so I was always a Black 17er on roulette. And I'd go up, put, you know, $2,500, 25 or a hundred, not 2,500, you know, a $25 chip, a $100 chip. And I'd put it on Black 17. And I can tell you, I hit that so many times, I can't, and it's 36 to 1, you know, you get 35, I forget how they do it, but I think it's 36, I think the payout, but I think it includes your 100, when you get paid out, you get $3,600, and I can't tell you how many times I did that, and that I would hit it. I've done it in St. Louis quite a few times, that place in St. Charles. I've done it there about, well, I haven't done it in years, you know, I rarely gamble anymore, but I used to, you know, do it all the time. And so I suppose the odds were with me a little bit on that stuff, too. And maybe there's some truth to the universe. Let's put it that way, to this universe thing that people like to talk about and say the universe gives you what you ask for. It's an interesting concept, and I don't know that I believe it or not, but, you know, some people have that belief that the universe is what you need to, I don't want to call it praying, but the universe is what you need to come to grips with, not religion. You know, there's certainly that group of folks out there. And anyway, whatever happens, I can tell you that the extreme ends of either end. If I get in the ocean, I'm getting eaten by a shark. If I fly over a natural disaster, I'm going to get blown up in the disaster. And every once in a while, if I go to Vegas and put $100 black chip on black 17, I'm going to hit that puppy on a fairly regular basis. So I need to go there more often is what it seems. But I wanted to talk about natural disasters and weather and a couple of things like that, because there's been a decent amount of that in the news. And you know, all of the stuff that goes on in the world, you know, I don't know how to disputes, disagreements, stupidity everywhere. And you just, you know, I suppose that some of the things that we all have to go through, no matter what, weather, freezing your butt cheek off, you know, that people have to pay attention to that because we all go through it. And wherever you are with the weather, you'll want to be somewhere else. You know, I'm not a particular huge fan of Florida. I don't mind being there once in a while, but I didn't really like being there, you know, on a constant basis. I particularly enjoy Missouri in the fall. Rest of the year, please don't take this wrong or come and beat the hell out of me at the Lake Ozark Real Estate of the Art Studio. But rest of the time, for me, it's take it or leave it. But I enjoy fall. It's my favorite time of year, and it is the one time a year that I find Missouri to be very, very pretty. And but other than that, you know, it's I'd probably prefer to be traveling the planet. You know what I mean? I don't mean anything bad by that. It's just I'm much more into the fall. But weather, wherever you go, you know, and I lived in Qatar and it was, you know, 115 degrees daily, you know, and very dry. Well, it was very humid in the months of August, September, but the rest of the time it was pretty dry. And I didn't mind that all that much. But I don't want to be so. I wanted to go to St. Petersburg. I've already told you that, and see a real Russian winter. I've only been to Russia in the winter once, and it was in Moscow, and it was years ago. And I don't remember being all that horrible or slow people down or anything like that. And kind of like Minnesota, you know, the weather never slowed you down up there. And, you know, it was very good. And everybody learns to deal with the weather. But the weather's kind of been in the news. So, you know, in the world, they don't care what your belief structure is. They don't care, you know, what your government thoughts are. They don't care what you do for a living. Doesn't care about summits, speeches, elections, morality, moral framework. It's, you know, physics, pressure, limits, that's what it is. And, you know, this week, you know, we've had some pretty interesting limits being pushed everywhere. Let's start with Kamchatka in the Far East Russia. 9-meter waves. 9 meters. That's pretty freaking high. Waves. Storm warnings across the Pacific in the Bering Sea, the Bering Straits. And 9 meters, that's not rough weather. That's like a wall of water taller than your house. You know, that's some, you know, ships fail in that. Ports are shut down because of that. Rescue becomes near impossible. You know, if you're rescuing somebody, you're gambling with your own life. in that time. And so, you know, and Kamchatka is not some, you know, irrelevant outpost. It's a, you know, the Pacific access. It's the Arctic approaches. It's everything. It's the Bering Strait corridor routes that, you know, both militarily and economically really matter. These are, and it's bad times up there right now. And so when the sea gets violent there, the disruptions are pretty, they're felt in a lot of places. So you can sanction a country, you can blockade the port, you can issue statements, but you can't really negotiate with a 9-meter wave. You know, that's not going to happen. And so, and related, you know, on the other side of the Pacific and the Pacific Northwest of the U.S., they're drowning under, you know, some atmospheric issues of their own, right? You know, the rivers are rising, and there have been roads that have vanished, evacuations everywhere. You know, the weather is kicking the crap out of the Pacific Northwest as well, and they got landslides. And, you know, we're no third world developing country or a failed state. Well, you could argue some of that. We're supposedly wealthy, infrastructure heavy, you know, supposedly, in that region, you know, but it always is discovering over and over that, you know, development doesn't necessarily equal immunity. I mean, how many tornadoes we get in the Texas, Oklahoma, Missouri, you know, the panhandle part down there? How much you get? You know, what do you get? Lots of them. I mean, and also at the same time right now, there are huge bushfires burning out of control all over Australia, right? Homes are burning. There's extreme heat, erratic wind. You know, a firefighter was killed yesterday by a falling tree. So you got floods on one side of the planet, fire on the other. And there's a lot of things that don't necessarily depend on politics, which we like talk about, or that aren't related. You know, they don't. They might make a pause, you know, too much water too fast or not enough water for too long. And you know, it's one extreme or the other. I mean, right now, Sri Lanka, Southeast Asia, cyclones everywhere, flooding, landslides there, displacement of people. And, you know, recovery takes a while. Economic strain is felt as a result of these things. This is, you know, it's not chaos, it's kind of a pattern, because this, you can't stop it. I mean, every year you have what? Tornado season in Florida, hurricane season, you know, it's Pacific Northwest, flooding season, landslide season, Southern California, fire season, you know, they get some fire starts and, you know, burns for months, you know, it's kind of what they're going through in Australia right now. And it matters, because it kind of interrupts the narratives that are, you know, that go along everywhere. You know, it's like, well, we got this. And one of the you know, the pressure, insurance markets, supply chains, repair cost, political patience, you know, everybody, what's the U.S. do? Oh, gee, FEMA, throw them another $1 billion and let's, you know, move on. Everybody forgets about it, keeps on moving on. So nature kind of accelerates the truth. You know, it's like, truth is, does any of the political crap really matter? You know, it everything kind of becomes personalized if you're one of the people involved in, like me this morning, freezing my butt off or you know, flying over a volcano. But, you know, let's, and what happens when weather hits the battlefield, right? Let's take everything we just talked about, you know, pressure, limits, the indifference of weather, you know, doesn't care who it's affecting. It's just, it is, you know, like a Mount Everest is, you know, and let's talk about that with respect to war. Let's talk about that with respect to winter and Seversk and the collapse of illusions on the battlefield. I mean, what has Russia been doing? What has Ukraine been doing, trying to do in reverse in Russia, doing the same thing? They're trying to take out each other's energy infrastructure, heat, electricity. Why? Because it's a painful situation to have to live through winter with no heat. You know, I'm here complaining about, you know, 32 degrees, and I can turn on the heat, you know. Costs me more, drives me nuts, I don't like that. But they can't in Ukraine. You know, they get what? What was those latest stories? There's 16-hour blackouts. You know, you only get your electricity turned on so many times a day, and the heat doesn't get turned on except for like 4 to 8 hours, something like, depending on where you live. And so, you know, the no pause, winter is not, you know, a nice scenery picture in Ukraine, could be, but winter's like a multiplier, a force. That's what it is. The cold is killing the batteries in your vehicle, the vehicle itself. Wounded soldiers, you know, die in the freezing cold. I'm here complaining, you know, I ain't laying in the snow, you know. It kills morale, kills logistics, kills food supply. You know, how do you get any food to the battlefield? It attacks, you know, energy first, heat, electricity, water, rail. Every winter, repairs are critical. You know, it's a race against time because the haves make it forward and the have-nots. You know, if you're not warm, you're not fighting, you know. Let's talk about that in relation to the battlefield that nobody is really talking about, the Seversk. There was a German journalist and a war correspondent that wrote an article the last couple of days. His name is Thomas Roper. And after the fall of Seversk, which was taken basically yesterday, what he said was, this is probably the last fortress before the Donetsk River. Do you remember me talking about that? About the steppe and the plains and what happens over there. And it's going to be especially brutal in the winter. And so basically, the hills and the populated centers are further on the east. And then once you cross that area to get into the western Donbass and where Seversk is, and you get to keep going all the way to the Donetsk River. The Donetsk curves to the west right there too, but you could arguably, it's nothing but plains, and there aren't any large population centers between Seversk and a lot of Seversk and going all the way to the Donetsk River. And from the very beginning, I remember when somebody was first interviewing me about this years ago, 3-4 years ago, when the war first started, and I was talking about historic Russia, where Russia was in relation to Ukraine and all of that. And I basically said everything east of the Donetsk was basically Russian. And, you know, of course, I'm not saying there weren't Ukrainians there, and I'm not saying it wasn't part of Ukraine that was gifted by Khrushchev to Ukraine during Soviet Union times, but historically, native Russian, okay, and west of the Donetsk, farm, you know, the Ukraine means on the edge, on the frontier. Now Krayach means on the edges, and Ukraine, that means you're by the edge. And so that was, the further west you went, the more in the frontier you were, but it was all Russia, right? It was all Russian Empire for the last 1,000 years. And there was never a separate Ukraine Empire, you know? And that was just where they were. Their language deviated, you know, because of the influence from the Poles and the Baltic states and stuff like that. And a Germanic state, Austria-Hungary, over there. And but it's a wide, flat plain all the way to the Donetsk after this. And so the weather, you know, Thomas Roper says that there's, you know, not much left to stop the Russians, now that they've gotten west of Seversk. And, you know, that's not a Kremlin spokesperson. That's not, you know, a war, I don't know what, general, commander, you know, nobody like that. It's a German journalist describing the geometry of the battlefield. And Seversk wasn't really symbolic. It's more structural. It's a fortified position that anchored Ukrainian defenses. And with it gone, the road is open toward Kramatorsk, Slovyansk. You know, these are command hubs. These are logistical places. And his assessment is that the Ukrainian forces are extremely low on personnel. There's been some discussion that they are completely out of reinforcements. They don't have anybody left to get, you know, unless they lower the age to 18 or something from 25 that it's at now. But they've already let most of those guys leave the country. Sorry about that. Get a little bit of coffee. Still got a bit of a scratch in the throat. The strategy, you know, the Ukrainian strategy, basically, hold the ground at any cost, period. And there, people are dying. I'll tell you about Mirnograd and Pokrovsk. In Mirnograd, there was a... they were completely encircled in Mirnograd after the fall of Pokrovsk. And it's... A month ago, I was telling you there were 5,000 soldiers in each place, 6 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, I was telling you that they're down to about 2,000 in each place. Now, they aren't showing, there's still an effort on the Ukraine side to say, oh, gee, we're holding it. But they've lost all 10,000 of those troops in Pokrovsk, Mirnograd in the last 4 or 5 weeks. Russians' estimates were 47,000 soldiers in the month of October lost on the Ukrainian side. Another estimate, which isn't really an estimate, and now they're talking about it. A lot of people have said, I say it's closer to 1.5 million, because I've been following it from the very get-go in the four-year period. But now, even Western military strategists and commentators and people like this guy Roper have been saying that now they've passed 1 million, now that Ukraine is more than 1 million. I think it's quite a bit higher than that. Certainly, it's much higher if you count the wounded, and if you count the desertions, if you count the people. There's still about 200,000 that have been charged with desertion. So, attrition has replaced any sort of maneuver. The Ukrainians have been commanded, you will hold this ground at any cost, including all the lives of the entire unit, you know, and that's what's happened. Certainly in Mirnograd and Pokrovsk, and arguably in Seversk too. And so now the lawn that should line, I mean, that should worry us or worry them is... and because they're not doing it, is anybody who had any sort of brain on that side of the equation on the Ukrainian side would get some negotiations going. So why aren't they? You know? I don't know. A pause now? What does a pause now do? Does it freeze the battlefield? No. It reshapes it. So this brings me to the discussion by Sergei Lavrov. Because he gave an hour and a half. He was at an hour and a half, call it a round table, is what they were talking about. And I only got to listen to the first 30, 40 minutes, which was mostly him giving the, some prepared remarks, and he was talking about it. And once again, they were talking about because Europe is still pushing, as is the U.S. partially. They keep framing the necessity for a ceasefire to engage in talks. And there's been several commentators talk about it in the last, week or two, especially. It's, especially as the holidays come up, that have been talking about ceasefire. And Lavrov reminded everybody once again of, well, we've been saying for years that no, we will not just agree to a ceasefire to allow them. He said it again. He said it just like I said it. He goes, I don't know, I've repeated this a number of times because, it, especially in Europe, but in the West, he said, and especially in Europe, a ceasefire under the current conditions isn't equal to peace. It just isn't, because it's recovery time. It is time for them to, and he listed them. He listed it out. Rotate exhausted Ukrainian units out. Give them a little bit of a break, he said. They need a break. Retrain, hopefully. Get some, remember, they're sending their conscripts straight to the front to be trained by the frontline units. That's not a strategy that is worthwhile. They need a pause. They've been begging for this ceasefire because they need a ceasefire in order to regroup. They want to integrate and have shipped new Western weapons that they want to repair rail and energy infrastructure and hopefully rebuild a little bit of morale for them. And so a pause in the a ceasefire, a small stop in the hostilities redistributes the advantage of the Russians and makes it a little bit more, allegedly equal, or gives the Ukrainians a call it a fighting chance, even though, they're all being forced to fight and be destroyed anyway. And with Seversk gone and winter biting, they need that stop now more than ever, because, the advantage, advantage Russia, is going to turn into game, set, match Russia, according to Lavrov, if they keep the pressure up and not have any sort of ceasefire that allows Europe to resupply, allows Ukrainians to propagandize and come another way and hopefully facilitate some sort of resupply, redistribution on the remaining front lines, although Seversk, Petrovsk, Mirnograd, Kupiansk, these are big cities, and they are all basically, and these are not small, that are all basically gone. I think it was, I can't remember the one up in Kharkiv where they were talking about where they pushed them out, and now the Ukrainians are saying, no, we won't leave that area. It's Western Donbass, and we won't leave. But the civilians are being evacuated or told to leave, one way or the other, because the Ukrainians can't hold it anymore. And so that's the next big one. And then, now they're talking about Kramatorsk and these other historically vital cities as far as production, as far as manufacturing and stuff like that. It's weather isn't helping, and weather is very important in this. Just like all of the weather issues stop, events stop reality for a little while, or change your reality, maybe is better. You know, your reality. The winter is changing the reality. You know, reality is Ukrainians were losing anyway. And now the reality is that in the winter, they're going to lose even quicker, especially if Russia doesn't agree to a cessation so that they can enjoy the holidays. They aren't going to be enjoying the holidays anyway. And neither the Russians, by the way, not in that area. But, you know, from Moscow's perspective, agreeing to a ceasefire now means stopping while their momentum is at its peak, so that momentum could be rebuilt against them. And so that logic isn't ideology. It's a military arithmetic. And in winter, you know, is magnifying it, I suppose, would be the best word. Winter is showing it that it's there. So that brings us to another, in my view, real problem. What's the real problem? The real problem, it's not winter. It's not Seversk. It's not even attrition. But the fact, and I've said this, I can't tell you how many times since I have started this show, you know, we're in season two here, and I don't know how many started on this. I think it was show number 240 or something like that, 241, that has been, that I have done. And the problem isn't any of those things. I've talked about this before. It's the death of diplomacy itself. The diplomacy doesn't exist anymore. I mean, think about it. It's just not here. You know, Lavrov kept talking, and he was talking about the same stuff when Tucker Carlson interviewed Putin so long ago. When people have talked, when people talk anything about history, when the Russians talk about this, they go, look, historically, east of the Donbass, or east of the Donetsk, Odessa included, by the way, which isn't really east of the Donetsk, but Odessa, Mykolaiva, those two oblasts, regions are also historically Russian. The ports in Odessa, they weren't built by Ukrainians. I mean, they were built by people who lived in Odessa, but they were in the Russian Imperium, right? That port of Odessa has been Russian for 1,000 years, just like Sevastopol, you know, just like any other major Russian port was always Russian. And so when they talk about these things, they're talking history. They're talking ports. They're talking shipyards, shipbuilding, the Black Sea. They're talking the Black Sea access, economic arteries, and everything. Those were prime areas of Russia and Soviet Union for 1,000 years, way before Ukraine. So when you talk about this sort of geography and Russia saying from the beginning, look, it's historic Russians, Ukrainians keep demonizing all things Russian and destroying the people and blowing them up, especially post-2014, you know, you're destroying your own history, for God's sake. And there was no separate Ukraine, you know, there just wasn't. It became separate when Khrushchev gave it up, you know, and Stalin some before that. And they talk about this history and they go through the history, you know, and when you're talking about geography and history, I mean, hell, you could argue that in Brest, which is up in Belarus, and that was awesome. A visit, an awesome tour that I went to, that was a World War II stronghold. It was a stronghold of the Lithuanian kingdoms, Polish kingdoms for a long time. And the history there has been overrun. Europe the crossings and the wars that have covered Europe have gone on for centuries, you know, in a place that's, you know, smaller than the United States. And so imagine, I mean, like our Civil War, North and South, you know, we talk about that. That's our war of history. Well, how many times has that gone on in Europe? How many times? I mean, the Mongol hordes crossed through there, for God's sake. The Turkish Empire went through there, you know. The Ottoman Empire, you know, Ottoman Turks. And the Romans, Greeks. I mean, however far back you want to go, this place has been a war zone for centuries. And so you might say that it's not fair for Russia to say, oh, gee, that's all Russian anyway. What are you bitching about? And it's not fair for Ukraine to deny that it was, you know, that they were part of the Russian Empire and part of it. Now, the Polish was clearly different. You know, they're related, but not the same. The Ukrainians, they were, you know, in the same group with the Russians. Always, historically, they've never had their own Ukrainian country. They're trying to change that history now, you know, and tell everybody, oh no, Ukraine was, you know, Ukrainian Rus, not Russian Rus. You know, that's not how it worked. So you could argue the semantics of all of this, but the fact is nobody knows what's going to happen here. And the diplomacy part being dead and compromise being non-existent. You know, geography doesn't compromise. You know, throw in the trouble with my thoughts on diplomacy, and diplomacy dying is because you used to be able to get together and come to a resolution by talking, by creating a strategy, by coming up with good ideas. And there's a couple that have come up here recently that I wanted to talk about. The old Z Monster is pushing another one now. He wants to turn the whole Donbass into a economic zone, stop hostilities. Neither one of us get it. So that's his fallback position. Neither one of us get the Donbass, which are Donetsk and Lugansk, and they want to, you know, Zaporizhia, throw that in there as well, and depending on which version you're listening to, right? And not that we have lost these territories already from Ukraine. You're not hearing that. You're still hearing, well, wait a minute. If you're forcing us to take territorial losses, let's take a step back here and say, well, all right, U.S., why don't you just take it over as an economic zone? And we'll do that if you give us security guarantees. Again, with the security guarantees, you know, you beat up Russia for us, big brother. And we'll let you have these security zones. You beat up Russia for us, big brother, and we'll give you, you know, $100 billion resources deal for generations to come, which has already happened. So let's talk about the history of that, which unfortunately everybody remembers, because everybody remembers Minsk 1 and Minsk 2. For years, Minsk was sold as peace, right? This is how they got Putin to not react back in, 2014, 20, I forget which years it was, but it's gone on for, 10, 15 years. So the Western leaders then, you know, 3-4 years ago, and even Zelensky admitted it, told the truth finally, that the agreements that we made in Minsk were never were never true. We weren't trying to resolve the matter. We were buying time. And they've been pretty upfront about it. And that admission, more than anything else, when you look between Russia and Europe, and, you know, the West, completely, the globalist West, that admission by the parties involved, France, Germany, Ukraine, three of the four, that admission killed any trust. And that is what we're dealing with right now, okay? From Moscow's point of view, from Lavrov's point of view, he was there, he remembers it. You know, the new guy on the block, you know, the Rubios of the world, the Trumps of the world, although Trump, you know, knew about all these things before from his previous term in office. So from Moscow's point of view, Minsk is proof. Another, look what you did last time. It's proof that diplomacy is really just another weapon, just another tool of the globalist elites. If, you know, diplomacy, as they call it, you know, Western diplomacy. And Lavrov brings it up as a warning pretty frequently. Basically, he says, you already admitted that you lied to us the last two times, Minsk 1 and Minsk 2. Why in the world should we believe you again that this ceasefire is just, you know, we're going to end the conflict? You know, that's, you know, they don't want to do just a ceasefire. They want to end the conflict. Russia says, we will talk. We'll continue talking and we will talk to end the conflict. That's what we will do. But we won't give you a ceasefire to regroup, reform, resupply, everything like that, because we don't trust you. Because diplomacy, you use, you know, diplomacy as a platitude to trick us, which is what you did in Minsk 1 and Minsk 2, and then just admitted, and the question has no answer. You know, there is no answer because it's absolutely true. This is why ceasefire proposals die on arrival most of the time. You know, this ceasefire, not because peace isn't desired, not because, you know, they're tired of lives, you know, being lost as well. It's because trust doesn't exist. Trust doesn't exist. And now take a little bit wider view of this lens. A little bit bigger. Where on the planet is Western diplomacy, true diplomacy, a true diplomat actually functioning? Is it working in Europe? No, they're a joke. It's fragmented, exhausted, reactive, you know, tweeted. You know, it's, oh, gee, it's pink. It's a pink flag or a multicolored rainbow flag. You know, is it working in South America? What's going on in South America? Is any of that diplomacy at all? No, it's a big brother says, you know, daddy says, and this is what's going to happen. You know, that's not diplomacy. It's BS. Is it working in China? No, they're building parallel systems. They're going, you know, we've had enough of this. You know, we're not your big bad wolf. We are not the enemy. And you keep wanting to make it. We just want to live. We just want to take care of our people. And we and you know, they're building parallel systems. Nobody's waiting for approval to do this. They're just doing it. India, talked about them some yesterday with Jai Shankar. They're non-aligned. They're transactional, and they're very patient. China's very patient. And time is going on. Time is continuing. And the problem is the quiet revelations that are always buried in Washington's strategy and discussions. You know, there's quiet things. You know, one of the most exciting things I read in the last 24 hours. It was, and I might share the whole thing with you because I really liked it. In fact, I think I will. Let me pull this up for you because it is a highly interesting proposal. Where is it? It was allegedly a Trumpster deal, but I got to find the damn thing. There it is. I found it. Here is the name of the article. Came out yesterday. And it is titled, "The U.S. is secretly planning a five-nation club, including Russia, to sideline the G7. Remember the G8? Oh, Russia's going to be invited back to the G8? And he said, you're not going to come, you know, we're not interested. What do we care? You know, you booted us out, turned into the G7. I don't give a rip. And so this group, so I'm going to share the whole article with you because it's really not that long. It's a short deal. So the U.S. is secretly planning, and I don't know how true this is. I haven't had any research, just this one story. But allegedly, the U.S. is secretly planning to create a five-nation power block with Russia, China, India, and Japan to sideline the Western-dominated G7. And this is several media outlets have allegedly reported this. The idea was reportedly outlined in a longer, unpublished draft of the U.S. national security strategy that I covered for you a couple of days ago, released by the administration of President Trump, you know, that came out. According to the Defense One news portal, the version circulated before the White House published the unclassified document and report, you know, reportedly proposed a new group. Little coffee there. Dubbed it as the Core Five, as a forum for dialogue among major powers outside of the traditional G7 framework. Under this plan, the five-nation format would hold regular summits similar to the G7, each focused on a theme: Middle East security, normalization of relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia, one of the first things allegedly to be on the agenda. This unpublished version allegedly says and lays out a plan to downgrade Washington's role in Europe, push NATO toward a tougher burden-sharing model that they've been talking about, and focus instead on bilateral ties with EU governments that are closer to the U.S., places like Austria, Hungary, Italy, Poland, and get away from France, Germany, England, you know, get away from the nut jobs. According to Politico, White House spokesperson Anna Kelly insisted that no alternative private or classified version exists beyond the official 33-page plan that I shared with you before. The Kremlin says it has seen no official statement from Washington on this reported plan and added that such claims they treat with skepticism. So the report comes against a backdrop of a long-running argument about Russia's place in existing Western-led groups. In 1998, the G7, which is the U.S., the U.K., France, Germany, Italy, Canada, Japan, was expanded to include Russia. But Russia was booted out in 2014 after taking or reunifying Crimea with Russia. And Trump has repeatedly said that removing Russia from that group was a big mistake, and that had Moscow remained at the table, de-escalation of Ukraine, you know, or the escalation in 2022, you know, with Russia going in and after a referenda in the Donbass, could have been prevented. And President Putin said in an interview with India Today this month, that I quoted for you last week or earlier this week, that Russia has no plans to join the G7. And he notes the group, you know, that the significance of that group is no longer important anyway, because England, France, Italy, Germany, these people, well, Germany, that's not fair. Canada, these people are not major economies when you look on the global sphere. And so focusing on them is probably, is probably a mistake and shouldn't be done that way and shouldn't go that far. And so I don't know. I found that to be interesting. And if that really is Trump's idea, you know, whether it's a Core Five, whether this Core Five principle is real or not, and whether Trump outlined it or not in a prior version of the security statement, the idea is pretty revealing. You know, it admits what everybody already knows. You know, the old West-centric order doesn't govern reality anyway? And if it was being proposed in Washington, even Washington is hedging their bets. And so, you know, Washington, according to some, you know, because there was a guy who also wrote an article that his name is Fyodor Lukyanov. And he, in his article, I'm wondering if I should share that with you as well, because it was a pretty good article. But basically, well, let's just go with the start of it. He argues that Washington no longer frames Russia as Mordor. You know, I'm telling you about that. You know, they always, the Ukrainians always thought it was really fun to call the Russian soldiers orcs, and they're not real people, so you just got to kill them. Basically, what do you do with an orc? You kill them. They're not people. They're not human, basically. And that was, you know, the tone is cold. You know, Russia is seen as part of Europe, but, you know, confined, you know, integrated, but subordinate, right? The junior pillar in a reconstructed European house, because, you know, the vision, you know, that vision, he says, belongs in the past, because the big three, Russia, India, China, they don't accept it. And much of the world doesn't even recognize it anymore. You know, they like to talk about Putin being isolated. He's not. Which brings us to Trump. So Trump claims that everybody in Ukraine, that was a pretty funny quote, everybody in Ukraine except Zelensky liked his peace plan, you know, his peace plan. He warns about World War III, and he's pressuring the Z-man for elections, which is, you know, I think he's doing so correctly. Strip away his personality, you know, Trump's. Excuse me, a little bit on the tired side. What Trump is signaling is this. That the war, there's still no clean off ramp for this war, you know, ceasefire, or because even Trump has changed his mind on that over the last 6 months, 8 months, you know. Well, we need a ceasefire, immediate ceasefire. You give me a ceasefire in a week. And then it was give me a ceasefire in a month. I want a ceasefire by September 1st. You know, I want a ceasefire by Thanksgiving, you know. Well, then he changed it after he met with Putin, and Putin says, listen, you're not paying attention. A ceasefire only does what we just said, and whoever's giving you this advice that tells you that we're going to agree to a ceasefire are nuts, you know, because we've said we're not going to allow you to just to rebuild these, and your globalist, you know, pals over there that aren't really your pals, Mr. Trump, they are trying to keep you sucked into this, and the way they do it is with a ceasefire, because then they can resupply, resubmit, all the things we've already talked about. So Trump now signals that the war doesn't have a clean off-ramp. He knows why. Territory is the unsolvable variable. You know, old Zelensky, the Z-man, wants to say that, oh, geez, we got to have the Donbass back. They never should have took it. Well, you never should have bombed the crap out of everybody from 2014 on. You never should have outlawed Russian. You know, it's nonsense. You never should have denied your own history and, you know, forced Ukrainization of, on ethnic Russians. And, you know, diplomacy is now like a, you know, little performing, dancing Zelensky. You know, escalation risk isn't, escalation is far more likely because of the lack of diplomacy. There is no diplomacy. Trump even says, you know, geez, we've got to watch out. World War III, you know, it's right around the corner. When World War III doesn't begin with a declaration, it begins when nobody trusts diplomacy enough to really try it. And, you know, frankly, how can you blame the rest of the world for being fed up with Western-style democracy, you know? And let's talk about this the Donbass trade zone that Zelensky wanted to talk about, a demilitarized, free, according, you know, free according to him, but basically he just wants the U.S. to do it. Investment instead of shells. It sounds, you know, pragmatic. You know, it's like, well, you know, that could be like Trump in Gaza. Oh, geez, we're going to turn this into a resort. Great. We don't want a resort. We want to live in our homes. You know, we want to live here without getting a crap bombed out of us or being destroyed by Israel every 10 minutes. I'm not saying right, wrong, and different. Just saying, you know, Trump turned into Trump Resort 3 is your 5 or 10 or whatever it is no solution. And so the Z-Man is coming up with this Z-militarized free economic zone. Give me some investment. And it sounds, you know what? That might be a pretty good idea. But quietly, it's admitting something huge. Military victory of Ukraine, of the West, is no longer assumed. It's not presumed. They know they're losing. So peace is being reframed as economics. Well, what idiot wouldn't want to, increase economy for everybody? Why wouldn't we want to go back and, you know, go back to making money and living with each other and dealing with things the way they should be? But you can't build a trade zone without sovereignty. Somebody has to be in charge. Security guarantees. I mean, who's going to be in charge? U.S.? Do you think Russia would allow that? I don't think so. That gives them exactly what they've been saying they don't want. The whole, you know, instead of the NATO on the shores of Western Russia or the border of Western Russia, you get all of America. But, you know, put in your nuclear bombs, you know, if you wish. And what about security guarantees and legitimacy? Precisely what diplomacy has failed to resolve for years. That's not planning for peace. That's post-war fantasy while the war is still burning on, right? And then throw Venezuela into that mix. So there have been repeated stories here in the last few days after the seizing of this tanker. I talked a little bit about that a day or two ago, where Putin is backing Maduro as the U.S. seized the tanker and deploys more Navy assets, sanctions, you know, meet sovereignty claims, power is answering to the pressure. Same logic in a different theater. Diplomacy completely replaced by leverage, you know. Storms don't negotiate. Winter doesn't pause war. Geography doesn't forgive mistakes. You know, geography's geography. Minsk taught the world that diplomacy is deception, or a huge part of it is deception. Remember me telling you about a game I used to play? I learned it in high school from my German teacher. I can't remember her name, Frau something. My brother would remember because we played these game is called Diplomacy. Many people have played the game Risk. Imagine a game of Risk, but no dice, right? And you have 8-10 players, you know, each a different country, making alliances. Starts around World War I, and you ease through up through World War II, and it's basically a lesson in how to negotiate. Everybody moves all at the same time. You have a move every 24 hours, okay? And everybody moves their military or builds fleets, builds this, builds that. And you go to, so if you're Austria-Hungary, you make an alliance with Germany to protect the common border, and you focus on building something on the Mediterranean, you know, fleet. Austria-Hungary going to build a fleet down below. Meanwhile, you've made this deal, but France is making a separate deal with Germany at the same time, you know, and this deal is, hey, we want to come in and take a chunk of Austria-Hungary. We want to take the Austria chunk and push Hungary further over. You support us in that, and we'll help you kick the crap out of England up on top here because we're, you know, it's, it makes sense to us. And so you make all your negotiations, and the game is called diplomacy, right? And so you make all your negotiations, your moves, and then everybody comes in and finds out who's truthful and who's not, who screwed who. And every turn, somebody got screwed. Every turn, somebody is there. Well, this is all that is going on these days is the exact same thing. And Russia has been the recipient of the lies so many times. I quit playing, you know, about halfway through the year. I was like, geez, you know, I don't want to have a discussion with you one day and then the next day find out that you were lying to me and then have you want to come back to me and discuss another deal. Well, no, it's a different way. Things have changed now. You know, I already have taken England. You know, I would now I'll help you support. And I only did it so that I could support them. And you're listening to all their justifications for why they screwed you the time before, right? And unfortunately, Russia has been the recipient of that method of diplomacy too many times. It's history for them. You know, they got screwed the whole way. We're there. We're allies with them. America, England, everybody is. Russia helps defeat Hitler. What happened right after that? What happened? Russia starts trusting them. Russia became the enemy more than, I mean, geez, if anybody should have never been included back into the fold, it should have been Germany, right? Nope, it was Russia. You know, it was everybody hates Russia, and they continued. And so this is a long-term history lesson for you and a diplomacy lesson. You want to say, you know, Russia doesn't trust anybody. Well, all you got to do is check out history. Minsk 1, Minsk 2, Budapest Accords. Go back further. Keep on trucking. You go all the way back 1,000 years. You could talk about the Lithuanian Empire when they were talking, you know, because they had agreements with Poland. You can talk about what occurred in Brest and how many times that happened and they were overrun back and forth because that was the western half. Well, you can talk about it with Ukraine and where Russia was and how many times. I mean, geez, they go back. Putin even talks about Napoleon, you know, going back, and they know their history far, far better than I do, for God's sake. And so this trust, the currency of trust is gone. And it's, I don't know. What are we going to do about it? Seriously. And diplomacy is dead. You know, when you're Putin and you're, and I talked about this yesterday when I talked about the seizure of the vessel. Now we know it was seized in Venezuelan waters, you know, that it was off the coast of Venezuela. You can't do that. That's, you know, that's a war act is what that is. And we justify it by claiming sanctions and claiming all this other crap. I get the arguments. I get it. But I also think that it is erosion of even more on a much larger picture. Because the rest of the world is looking at this and they aren't going, oh, gee, the U.S. is the cool kids and they're doing us a favor. They're going, we're next. That's what's happening. We're next. And I don't know that this makes it a better, more safe world. Frankly, I tend to believe not, you know, that it pushes us closer to the brink to, you know, people do talk about this potential for World War III. You know, this stealing of the Russian assets. You know, we have FICO. Or FITO, I don't know how you pronounce it, but Slovakia won't back a reparations loan for Kyiv proposed by the European Commission. So shared that with you a couple of days ago. And now, excuse me, now England is doing more and more pushing to come to a resolution of this. And here's an article from the Financial Times, right? Lenders fear retaliatory lawsuits from Moscow. British bankers have pushed back against the plans to use frozen Russian assets. I think some people are finally starting to get it. If you have rules, the rules should be followed. If you don't follow the rules, everybody recognizes it. You know, if you have kids and you're a parent and you recommend to your kids, boy, don't smoke, don't drink, don't use drugs, don't do these things, but you smoke, you drink, you use drugs, your kids see it. And that incongruency doesn't do you any favors. You know, if you're not practicing what you preach, well, you're going to run into some problems. And that when, on a world level, it's an even larger problem. British bankers are pushing back. Kiev's Western backers have frozen $300 billion in Russian central bank assets, right? UK banks hold around $10.7 billion. And a dispute has emerged between Europe, pushing to use these funds as collateral for an alleged reparations loan, as if Russia owes reparations, right? And those that are firmly opposed to this that talk about the legal and financial risk. Moscow says it's theft. I say the same. According to the Financial Times, now UK bankers have objected to the plan, although a week ago they were all for it. They now say, we're concerned about the legality. Oh, really? That's because it's illegal. That's because it's illegal to seize a ship on the water. You can't do that. The government is setting new precedent because they have never seized assets in this type of way, said one banker, and Russia will sue them. The legal risk is that if Ukraine doesn't pay the money back, you need to repossess an asset that the government says is yours, but Russia says is not. The expectation is that this is not a loan, but a gift, and banks know they will need to repossess the underlying collateral. They know Ukraine's not going to pay this back. So where would the money come? We'll steal it from Russia. And the bankers warned that this would be a certain default event. Left out, you know, the banks will be left out to dry when Russia sues, because Russia will win, because it's illegal. UK officials declined to say whether the government is going to offer them any indemnity. So those are the UK bankers, but the UK government is saying that they will do it. Why don't they just give, if you're going to do that, you give the money to Ukraine. The UK's plans for the assets are coordinated, which holds most of the fund, you know, with the EU, the funds. And on Friday, the bloc is due to vote on a move to indefinitely immobilize the share of assets in the jurisdiction, Europe, under an emergency legal mechanism that would keep the funds frozen until Russia pays reparations to Ukraine. Analysts say this clause would override objections from countries opposed, like Hungary. EU states are set to vote next week. Belgium, which holds the funds, says it's against the move. France, Luxembourg, Germany, Italy, Hungary, Slovakia have objected as well. But, you know, they might do it anyway. I tell you what, if you ever want to cure things, you ever want to talk about diplomacy, you ever want to talk about rules-based order, Hillary Clinton last week in Doha, you got to apply the same rules to everybody, right? You got to do it. And the trouble is we never do. And thus, diplomacy is dead. Diplomacy doesn't exist. And it doesn't exist because nobody pays attention to it, do they? It just, I don't know. Somebody needs to do something a little bit different than what they are. Let's see. Remember me yesterday talking to you about engineers, and India, China, Russia, and the huge amount that they have? I wanted to follow up a little bit on that. 1.4 billion population in India. And India and Russia, you know, I talked to you a little bit about this yesterday. They share a lengthy relationship. The special and privileged strategic partnership between Russia and India has been growing steadily under Narendra Modi and Vladimir Putin. And President Putin visited India on the 4th and the 5th. He attended the 23rd India-Russia annual summit. During the visit, the leaders took part in an India-Russia business forum. They highlighted opportunities in bilateral trade, finance, investment. The visit was a significant milestone in the relationship, and they signed 16 memorandums of understanding and agreements across 7 fields, including migration and mobility. As noted by Prime Minister Modi, India is emerging as the skill capital of the world with more than, get this, more than 600 million workers. India's young talent has the potential to meet global requirements in every field, he said, and underscores the importance in India's growth story. Modi called for a complete reform of labor laws into 4 functional codes, and these codes are based upon the principle One Nation, One Law, covering 4 broad spheres of labor: wages, industrial relations, social security, and occupational safety. So in November 2025, the government of India implemented these 4 new codes. The Code on Wages 2019 standardizes the definition of wage, worker, employee, and introduces a legally binding floor wage for consistent pay across states. The Industrial Relations Code proposes a balanced framework that benefits workers, employees, and economy, creating a worker reskilled fund for workers who have to be retrenched, short-term relief, unemployment, stuff like that. So, tell you what, they are changing rapidly, and India has paid special attention to empowering women through these reforms by reinforcing the principle of equal pay for equal work, allowing women to participate in all sorts of work, including night shifts, and offering the option to work from home for those returning from maternity leave. By creating these nationwide reforms and aligning labor law with the present economy, these reforms reduce the compliance burden and help in attracting foreign investment, including investment from Russia. Russian companies interested in the Indian market will greatly benefit from simplified recruitment rules and ease of doing business. The reforms focus on reskilled labor. All of these measures will greatly assist Russian companies to manufacture in India and partner with Indian companies. I say this because they're continuing to grow as India marches toward realizing its dream of Viksit Bharat, developed India, and becoming a $10 trillion economy by 2047. These reforms will become a key pillar in the growth story and benefit the partner countries in Eurasia. These reforms reflect Narendra Modi's principle of reform, perform, and transform, and India's commitment toward achieving inclusive, sustainable growth. So, I mean, there's a lot going on in India. And you know, Trump, did you see that he had the old JT, JR, I was reading and saying the same thing. I think he said something about it, and if he didn't, he should. The $1 million buy your citizenship in America so you can get a visa for $1 million. Maybe that's a good idea. I don't know. Bring some money, but who gets it? Who gets to pay? Is the $1 million split among, you know, Americans? We each get a quarter or something? Any adult? Or does the government get it? If the government get it, screw that. I mean, so what? So for years, there's been an immigration in America, a type of visa based upon investment. That's been around a long time. And so if you came over and employed a certain number of people, invested in a business of this, you know, that would employ this many people, created a new business that employed this many people, you would get a visa automatically. You know, if you came over and created a new company. And that number has gone up over the years, and it used to be a function of the income growth each year. You know what I mean? It had to be a certain number of employees, 10, 15 employees, something like that, or a certain level of investment, $2 million business, $3 million construction project, blah, 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 you know, whatever those were. And you would get those approved. So it was always available. It just, I don't know where I don't know enough about this $1 million right now that Trump is sending out. We shall see. And there was one other thing, you know, that I wanted to cover is Trump's, AI deregulation. U.S. President Trump signed an executive order Thursday to curb individual state-level regulation of AI until a nationwide policy is adopted. A fragmented legal landscape threatens America's AI competitiveness compared to China, said the U.S. government. The administration wants to avoid a scenario in which a patchwork of 50 different regulatory schemes governs what it views as an inherently interstate industry. Trump's advisor in the field, David Sacks, explained on X, an AI model can be created in one state, trained in another, deployed nationwide. Sacks said that there are more than 100 AI-related laws are already in force at the state level, with over 1,000 additional measures pending. At best, we will end up with 50 different AI models for 50 different states. A regulatory problem worse than Europe. Trump directed the Department of Justice to challenge one state court law deemed onerous. Washington will also use federal grants and government contracts to encourage states to align with federal policy. The measures are described as temporary, pending the adoption by Congress of a minimally burdensome national standard for the regulation of AI. The White House has cited ideological concerns, accusing Democrat states of imposing woke constraints on AI developers, such as requirements aimed at preventing algorithmic discrimination. This type of ideology meddling is how we ended up with Black George Washington, Sacks wrote, referencing a widely publicized situation last year in which Google's Gemini image generator tended to produce race-swapped depictions of historical figures in an attempt to maximize diversity. Trump administration and U.S. tech firms are placing heavy bets on AI as a driver of economic growth, though critics warn that massive investment in the sector is based upon uncertain profit projection and may be inflating a market bubble. There are also concerns about public backlash as rapid expansion of energy-intensive data centers needed to run AI has driven up electricity prices in many areas. Sachs emphasized that the new policy would not force communities to host data centers that they do not want. How do you like that? I tell you what, I think what I'm going to do for you today is I am in the way, as it were, of the 9 o'clock program, and I'm going to give us a Christmas song that we're going to get into and clear the way to get out of the way of our next wonderful host here at Lake Ozark Real Estate of the Art Studio and on Dam Radio. And so I think what I'm going to do is put on a longer playing Christmas song and ease on out of here a little bit early. I ask you all to listen to Dam Radio every morning, 7:30 to 9. Here with me, I enjoy being here. I like doing it, or I wouldn't. And I like having you. And if you wish to hear all of the prior shows on Dam Radio, you can go to damradio.com/podcasts and listen to all of the prior shows. JR does a pretty good job of getting them out there. International Flavor, I put out on a daily basis, and it goes out to internationalflavor.com for your listening pleasure. And you can get the podcast out there and go back to the ones. I do the heavy research about twice a week. I put on some pretty good ones. And yesterday's, I think, bears a re-listen if you haven't heard about it, discussing some of the things going on in the world. So I encourage you to listen to us daily and appreciate you being here. I got to pick the right song here. What do we want for a Christmas song? Something a little bit longer, yeah? So that it goes further down the road. Let's do it. Here's some Jimmy Buffet, right? We all like Jimmy Buffet, don't we? And here he comes. Have a nice day. Glad you're here.